Welcome to the Dancer Mama Podcast, a show about motherhood for pole dancers, athletes, and entertainers. Join me, Jenna Alyssa, a pole dancer, stripper, and first-time mom, as I chat with fellow dancer mamas and knowledgeable experts on all things pregnancy, postpartum, parenting, and pole. Tune in every Tuesday as we add our voices to the motherhood conversation. Hey everyone, Jenna hopping on here before the episode to give a quick content warning. There is some discussion in this episode of sensitive topics, including fertility challenges, pregnancy loss, NICU stays, and caring for a child with complex disabilities. So if any of these topics may be sensitive or triggering to you, please feel free to skip this episode or just mentally prepare yourself before listening. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Dancer Mama Podcast. This is your host, Jenna Alyssa, and I'm back today with a special guest episode. I'm here today with Emily Laura. Emily Laura has been pole dancing for over 12 years and teaching for 10. What started as a hobby that she began pursuing during law school and her early days as a lawyer has evolved into a great passion. She eventually left law in 2021 when her oldest son was 1 year old and now teaches pole and flexibility full-time. Emily Laura has amassed a wide range of qualifications and certifications in order to best serve her students, making her offerings as a teacher thorough, unique, and grounded in physiology. Emily is a mama to two little boys, the eldest of which has complex disabilities and is currently expecting her third. So Emily, thank you so much for carving out the time to come on the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah, I discovered your Instagram account when a listener of the podcast suggested I try to bring you on as a guest because she found you very inspiring. And then I checked out your account and it really stood out both for your unique style of pole, particularly heel work. You have a unique style. It seems like you've really honed over the years, but also just your range of certifications.
Yeah, I'm a nerd. I love qualification.
Well, yeah. And then hearing that you went to law school, so you must have somewhat of a passion for education or educating yourself.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, that's only to the benefit of your students, but we'll get more into that. So I always like to start out with just a pole origin story. So if you want to share a little bit about how and when you came across pole and what kind of sparked that interest for you.
So I came across pole I'll start at the very beginning. So when I went to, even before university, I was very, very physically active. I used to ride on the dressage team for Great Britain. So yeah, very, very sporty, very active. And then I went to university and I did martial arts. And I met a boy who is now my husband. Mm-hmm. And when I moved in with him, I was like, I need a hobby away from you. I love you, but I need something for myself. And I tried adult ballet and it just wasn't challenging enough for me. And they had a pole dancing class in the room next door. And I just kept looking and was like, I really want to do that. So I just went for it. I went to my first class on my own. And it was just addictive. I mean, as probably most of the listeners know, once you start, that's it, isn't it, really?
Totally. Yeah, I think a lot of people have that experience. And I've said this before, that it can be addictive right off the bat, or there can be a bit of a learning curve through, like, say, your level one. And then once you're, like, climbing, then you're hooked. But a lot of people, most of the people I have on as guests who've made somewhat of their profession, it was like day one. They just knew.
For me, it was day one. And I think it's the fact that there's always something new to learn. You know, like I've been doing this for so long. And I've kind of gone through the stage of, I want to learn this trick, I want to learn that trick. And now I'm like, I want to dance in it more, I want to do this style. There's just always something new that you can challenge yourself with, which I love. Like I couldn't do the gym. I couldn't just go to the gym and run on a treadmill. I couldn't do running. It's just not the same kind of challenge mentally for me.
Yeah. And like you said, there's kind of no ceiling because there's just so much room for innovation. Yeah. And it's cool because it kind of can follow you through different seasons of life, where if you're not up to training tricks, you can focus on something else.
Completely. Like, I used to be, before kids, I was so, so focused on my big tricks, my flexibility moves. My biggest trick was the eagle. And now I'm like, do you know what? I've got two kids, one of whom is disabled and requires me to physically lift him a lot. I can't train like that anymore. It's too risky. I can't injure myself. I wouldn't be able to look after him. But there's still, you know, heels and flexibility training that I can still do without going sort of, you know, full out on the crazy tricks.
Yeah. And yeah, just considering like other aspects of your lifestyle and how that kind of shapes your pole training or is in relationship to it is something that is really worth exploring. I think we see people on Instagram and you can't compare yourself because you don't know how they've structured the rest of their life.
Yeah.
It may be that they're just in a stage of life where they don't really have any other demands on their time or energy other than pole, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's so true. And that will change throughout your life. Like, you know, before kids, I could train my butt off. I could absolutely exhaust myself and then I'd go and be a lawyer, but I was just sitting down, you know, like it wasn't physically demanding. Whereas now I'm like, I can't train like that because I then have to teach X amount of hours. I then have to run around after the kids.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, so for almost like a majority of the time that you had been doing pole and teaching, you were also working as a lawyer. So how was it like to balance those two things?
It was hard. Yeah, it was hard.
Like hard time-wise?
Hard time-wise. I always had the motivation to go to the studio and train, whether or not I was exhausted. I remember in my early days of law, I was on a huge, huge case that involved oil rights in Kurdistan. And it crossed, it was New York law, it was London law and Kurdistani law. And because of all the time zones, we were meeting at, you know, really odd hours of the day on Zoom and things like that. Probably wasn't even Zoom. It was that long ago. But I would get to the office at 9 a.m. and I would stay until 2 a.m. And that was 5 days a week. And sometimes I'd have to go in on the weekend. But I was adamant. Sundays was when I went to my pole dancing classes and I deserved a day off. Yeah, it was really hard, but I think I realized quite early on in my law career that I really enjoyed law school and I really enjoyed the academic side of law, but I hated the politics. I hated the office life. No amount of money could make me want to stay in a career where I had to do all those hours all the time.
Yeah, it's such a demanding schedule. I'd kind of heard that, especially earlier in the law career, it can be like that. I don't know.
Definitely. Oh yeah, it would be that I was there as a trainee, you know, into the small hours on my own, working my ass off, and the partners had gone home at 5.
Oh, that's so unfair. And then how long would you have to stick it out until you could like leave at 5?
I mean, realistically, like you'd be 2 years as a trainee. You're then a junior lawyer for like, I don't know, 6 years at least. Mm-hmm. So I'd be probably looking at least 15 years.
Oh my gosh.
And I just couldn't see, like, pole aside, I couldn't see how that was feasible as a lifestyle for me. Like, I like money, don't get me wrong. But if you have no time to actually spend it or enjoy your life, what's the point?
Yeah, I completely agree. Oh, wow, I didn't realize that it was quite that hectic.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask this bit later on, but I kind of want to ask now. So was that the main factor that played into your decision to eventually leave law, or was there other factors?
So that was the main factor that made me choose to leave working in London. I started moving. So I don't live in London. I live outside of London, but I was commuting in. So I moved to a law firm outside of London and the hours were a lot better, and then I cut down to 4 days a week. So I was in the office 5 days, but I had 2 half days, so I would go and teach and train on those half days. And I kind of knew where my heart was. I knew what I wanted to do, but let's face it, there's a lot more stigma attached to teaching pole dancing for a living than there is being a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And that definitely stopped me doing it, as well as the financial security. But then I had Arthur, who's my eldest son, and pregnancy was normal, but he has complex needs. When I went back to law, I asked them if I could cut down to 3 days a week to accommodate his therapy, his appointments, and they said no. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't do it then. I just can't. Like, he comes first. His appointments will always come first, and I will do what I have to do to make sure he has the best life. And being a lawyer wasn't conducive to that. Mm-hmm. So I left.
Wow. So that's a very like clear illustration of when you hear the barriers that women face when they're in like a professional career around motherhood.
Yeah, completely. It just, and I was in an office where there were mostly men. So I did property law, and it's definitely more male dominated. But do you know, I actually found sometimes it was the women in the office who were the worst, because they sacrificed. So I should have to sacrifice, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's like an internalized, like internalizing some patriarchal like structures and ideas to try to make it. And I can imagine it's hard because you have this kind of sunk cost mentality, I would imagine, of having gone to school and put in that grind early in the career.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. And law school is so expensive. And I'm lucky that I worked to the point that I didn't have any debt. So that was really nice. I don't know how people do it now, because it costs significantly more than when I went. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's kids do change everything, don't they? And he will come first.
And it's just sad that like mothering is devalued in that way, where they couldn't say, okay, you're an asset to our practice, but not enough that we can also let you a mom.
Yeah. The funny thing about it was I was completely transparent with them from very, very early on. They, you know, they sent me flowers when my son was in NICU, and I sent them a message back and was like, thank you for the flowers. I didn't actually see them because I wasn't at home for so long. Mm-hmm. This is what's happening. And I kept them in the loop the whole time I was away on maternity. And then when I returned, so I returned for 4 months before I left, I was so open with them, and I gave them my 3 months notice. And it was in the last week that they came back to me and said, you can have 3 days, don't leave. We can't spare to leave you. We can't bear to lose you. I'm like, oh, it's too late. I'm gone. My mind, my heart is not here.
It was like they were playing like a game of chicken with you. Like, maybe she'll change her mind. That's crazy.
It's like, I'm not going to change my mind.
Wow. Well, good for you having kind of the courage to make the right decision for your family. It's definitely like a mama bear instinct, I think, but also probably since you for years had already been kind of questioning it and wanting to maybe transition into working in your passion.
Yeah.
So you had been teaching while you were practicing law, like before your first son was born. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got started teaching pole and what led you to pursue some of the certifications you have?
So teaching, gosh, I can't actually remember why I started teaching. I think I was just like, I mentioned earlier that I was on the British team for dressage. My mum is a international judge and a dressage instructor. So I kind of had that family background of people who work in fitness and teach. So when I started pole, obviously I was completely addicted, and then I started thinking about the qualifications, and my mum at that time was very encouraging. And I think both her and my now husband were like, what do you have to lose? Go and do the course and see if you like it. It was very different, I think, back then to how it is now, maybe. So I went, I spoke to my studio owner about it, and something that the studio didn't offer at that point was spinny pole. And I absolutely love spinny pole. So she was like, yeah, if you go and become qualified, then it would be brilliant if you could teach a spinning pole class, because it wasn't, again, it wasn't a big thing 10 years ago, not like it is now. It certainly wasn't in England. So yeah, I did those qualifications with Spin City. And then I think the more I started teaching, the more I just wanted to know about how the body works. And I'd have students come to me with, you know, XYZ problems. I can't do this. This is how it feels. And I used to hate that I couldn't tell them why or give them a solution or give them recommendations. So I started looking into more qualifications, and then I did my yoga teaching diploma, which was, it was a really good course for me because it was split between anatomy and the more spiritual side. And that's when the kind of anatomy and exercise, that's when it kind of got me. And I was like, I love this. And then, yeah, I just kept doing more qualifications, really.
Wow, that's so cool. I love like the desire to be able to, well, help and just like know what's going on behind. Because we can walk through teaching someone like a fireman spin, but without some anatomical knowledge and physiological knowledge, you know, if we can't convey that aspect of it, injuries can occur, just even overuse stuff, right? So
yeah, and not even just injuries. There would be people saying to me like, why doesn't my fireman spin or attitude spin is a really good example with the hip mobility, why doesn't my spin look like your spin? Mm-hmm. And I would be like, oh, it's because I've practiced more. Mm. And that's not really helpful for my students to hear. Like, yeah, they want me to give them like, right, it's your internal rotation, it's your external rotation, if we work on this, you're going to see an improvement and you're going to start seeing your body moving how you want to see it move. I guess it's also, you know, having longevity in the pole industry. Like, I want to teach for a long time, and I think having a lot of knowledge will help me with that.
Absolutely. And also, yeah, like you said, the reason maybe you had that first teaching job was because you were willing or able to teach something that no one else was teaching at the studio at that time.
Yeah.
So being able to offer something a little different, right? Not just your standard class.
Sure.
Yeah, really cool. Is there any certification? Because when I was looking on your website, there's quite a few really cool, really spanning. What's one that stood out as just really interesting, unique, or helpful? I think other than the yoga.
Yeah, there's probably two. One is that I did an anatomy course, and that had nothing to do with fitness. It was sort of a straight up anatomy. The first module started at the cells, and we went through every single system of the body, and that just really made things click, like how the whole body works. And then I started, I'm one of those people who will sit in a lecture and I'm already thinking about how does this relate to other things that I teach. So that kind of started to draw all the information together for me. Mm. And then I did my pre and postnatal corrective exercise specialty, which is a bit of a mouthful. And that completely changed how I taught core engagement and pelvic floor in my pole classes. Even though it was a pregnancy course, pregnancy postnatal, it completely revolutionized how I taught and how I taught flexibility in relation to the core as well.
Did you take that before you were pregnant yourself?
I took that when I was technically on maternity leave with my second child.
Okay. So you were able to draw from your experience of having the first one without having taken that course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then go through my second like rehab stage. And now with the third pregnancy, I'm already writing myself a rehab program.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. I'm like, I should look into that because, yes. Yeah, sure. I mean, so that we can apply it to ourselves, let alone our students, and like whether our students are in a perinatal season or not.
Well, even if they're not, you know, thinking children, most of our students are female or are of childbearing ability, right. You know, and men have pelvic floors too. Everyone has a pelvic floor. Everyone has a core. So that information was just really useful to so many students, not just my mummies.
Absolutely. I think that's a good segue into talking a little bit about your specific pregnancy experiences. So let's start with the first one. Anything you want to share about how the pregnancy went, or just the journey through that stage and how maybe it took an unexpected turn?
Yeah. So my husband and I decided to start trying for kids. I think we'd been married a year or so. We've been together like nearly 10 years at that point. We've been together for 16 years. It's been a long time.
Wow.
And we went into that trying to conceive very naively, thinking, you know, you come off contraception, you get pregnant, you have a baby. And that was kind of it. My first pregnancy ended in miscarriage at 13 weeks. And that happened when I was teaching workshops in Germany. So that was we just emergency flew back to the UK because I was like, I just can't teach. I can't focus. Mm-hmm. So that happened. And fortunately, I actually fell pregnant 3 months after that miscarriage. And I had the most normal, boring pregnancy with my first child ever. It was completely normal. I did something called National Childbirth Trust classes, NCT, which in the UK is kind of something we do. It's supposed to teach you about how to be a mum and how to give birth, but really you do it to make friends with people who are having kids at the same time as you. A bit of an expensive way to meet people, but never mind. Everyone else was having extra scans and complications, and I just sailed through it. So I went into labor, and I thought I would have a nice home birth. And I went to 41 weeks and 5 days. I was huge. I was so big. Oh, my Lord, I was so big. And I don't know what it was, but I just knew something wasn't right. I just knew. And I asked to be transferred into hospital, and I was. And 48 hours later, he was born by emergency C-section. And I would actually say that my labor experience was really quite calm. Like I said, I didn't think something was right, and they just took me into hospital and they just looked after me. And my C-section was really calm, it was really nice, to be honest.
Sorry to interrupt, but I was just curious. So because you told them you felt something was not right, did the C-section start and you were not in labor yet?
So I was in labor. I'd been in labor for 48 hours and I didn't progress past 3 centimeters dilated.
Okay.
And I had contractions every 5 minutes.
Hmm.
So, and then I think I asked for an epidural at like 40 hours. And then my heart rate started going a bit funny. And that's when the doctor said to me, like, it's your choice. We can C-section or we can give you an epidural and see how it goes. And I was like, I'm done. 48 hours long enough. Let's just do it.
Yeah.
Then Arthur was born and everything seemed fine. Everything seemed normal. He took to breastfeeding. And then about 24 hours in, he started making funny noises when he was breathing, which I wasn't very aware of because, you know, I was exhausted and I was drugged, basically. And my husband was like, this isn't right. And we very quickly were in like the emergency room. We had a crash team. We had 3 doctors deep in a circle around him. I think I passed out. I was put in a wheelchair. And we were admitted to NICU. And then we were transferred to a more specialist NICU away from home. So down in Brighton on the coast, about an hour's drive from where we lived. And we were there for a few weeks and they stabilized him. He was fed with a NG tube during that time. We're lucky he didn't really need any oxygen after the initial stage, but they just noticed some peculiarities about his face. And they did some scans and they did an MRI on his brain. And that's when they said his brain is abnormal. It doesn't look how normal brains look, basically. But we were discharged without any more information than that, really. And, you know, he's 5 and a half now. We still don't have a diagnosis. We still don't know why, what has caused his brain to be like that. But he has severe global developmental delays. He can't talk. He can't feed himself. He can crawl. He's very happy. He communicates, but he's not verbal. But now, and he has very low muscle tone. So we now know that the reason I never dilated in labor was because he couldn't get in the right position because his muscle tone was too low and he couldn't physically curl himself up. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was a lot.
Goodness. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. I just can't imagine. I mean, especially as a first-time mom, how it must have been very scary. And especially since there was nothing in the pregnancy to kind of prepare you for that possibility.
Yeah. It was such a shock. It was such a shock at the time. And then, you know, I spent the first year of his life not just learning to be a mum, but learning to be a mum in a medical environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I mean, of course you wanted to cut back or even leave law. I cannot. And then for them to not have the compassion to right away reduce your hours is kind of crazy. But on a side note, I mean, poll seems less important in compared to everything you were going through, but what was your relationship to poll like through the pregnancy, but especially postpartum?
Through the pregnancy, I polled up until 40 weeks. I did stop teaching, but that was mainly because I was a lawyer as well. And, you know, your energy is just drained.
Yeah.
So my choice was teach or train for myself. And I chose myself. Mm-hmm. Postpartum, it was hard. It took me 18 months to come back to teaching. I did go back to pole. I think I can't even really remember how long it took me to go back to pole, but exercise wasn't on my mind in the same way that it was with my second and with this pregnancy. Because I think the separation, leaving him in NICU, affected me more than I realized. And I just did not want to leave him. I didn't want to leave him with anybody. So I, you know, going to the studio was out of the question. I did have a pole at home, but it wasn't easy to train at home. And also my recovery was just, I wasn't given the best shot because I was living out of a suitcase in a charity house. So if anyone ever goes to McDonald's and they are asked to round up their bill because it goes to Ronald McDonald houses, please do it, because my husband would have had to have driven an hour and a half each way to see my son in hospital if they hadn't put us up in accommodation. So my recovery was just awful. I swelled up like a balloon from water retention because I was not sleeping properly. I didn't have my own, I mean, we had a toilet in the room, but I got severely constipated because I just had no privacy and I was sat by his bedside. I didn't rest, basically. I spent that whole time trekking up and down to the hospital, and Brighton is hilly, to see him. It took me a lot longer than it did with my second pregnancy to come back and to want to come back.
Yeah. So my midwives, they were telling me, like, for my postpartum recovery, that I should try to do 1 week in bed, literally, mm-hmm. 1 week around the bed, not yeah. even doing chores. And then the third week starting to do small chores, like yeah. doing the dishes. I did not follow that advice for other reasons, but I'm like, that advice, there's a lot of privilege that would come with being able to yeah. follow that advice. Yeah. But it's sad because, like, we should yeah. be supported to do that, especially after a C-section and in this traumatic situation. But, like, I've heard other crazy stories about, like, NICU families. And yeah. I mean, I want to give the hospitals a benefit of the doubt, but it's they're just not set up to optimize the family's well-being in that situation.
No, it just isn't. And I think part of that is because we were in Brighton, and it is a very, very old hospital. So they couldn't have rooms for the family on even in the same building as the baby. I know that. So we go to a hospital attached to St. Thomas's called the Abilina, and we also go to Great Ormond Street now. And I know that their NICUs have family rooms, but I think it just depends on the hospital and how old it is and how it's been set up. Yeah, it was hard. It was really hard. And we were only there for a few weeks. I know families who were there for months.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm almost speechless. Thank you again for sharing. It's just another illustration of how different people's experiences can yeah. look. So moving forward, it took you some time to come back to pole and teaching and kind of adjusting into caring for your eldest. When did you get pregnant for the second time?
So we started trying quite soon after. I think I didn't get on with the pill that they gave me that I could take when breastfeeding. So we were kind of like, we don't want a big age gap anyway, so let's just see what happens. And we tried to conceive for 2 years, and it didn't happen. And we started to go through infertility testing, and I swear it was about a week after my first infertility test that I fell pregnant. Which just I don't know why that happened. It's just slightly amusing. And then I had another miscarriage, which was at 9 weeks. And then I think I fell pregnant 3 months after that. There's a 2.5 year age gap between my first and my second.
Okay. Wow. So kind of a fraught journey there again, and dealing probably with the extra mental and emotional stress of.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah. And COVID.
Superwoman. And COVID. Oh, that was during COVID too.
That was COVID. So I found out I was pregnant. I was 8 weeks pregnant, and we had to take my eldest to have an operation in London. And that was the day that the lockdown was announced in the UK. And it was, oh my gosh, it was like a ghost town. I have never seen London empty. And all of his doctors were in full hazmat suits. It was like a different world.
I can imagine seeing a city like London with empty. Almost no one there. It would be very eerie, like almost apocalyptic.
I mean, the traffic getting home was amazing, but yeah, it was apocalyptic. Oh, is the right word.
Wow. Oh my gosh. You must be such a strong person dealing with all of that. And then, yeah, caring for yeah. your child through COVID, I'm sure was hopefully that his appointments and stuff were not too affected, but I know everything was affected,
everything,
right?
Everything was affected. Everything was, like, he didn't have any appointments. We didn't have any physio, any occupational therapy input. Everything stopped.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, it's neither here nor there to talk about how that was managed at this point. That could be a whole yeah. other thing. But wow. So you were pregnant during COVID with your second.
Yeah.
Was it similar in that it was fairly, like, low symptom pregnancy?
Yeah, it was low symptom. I had bleeding, which I had in my first son, but because of my history of miscarriage and with my first son, they just gave me progesterone, and they weren't able to give me ultrasounds in the first trimester. I paid for them privately. The NHS wouldn't provide that because of COVID. The only difference really was because of my eldest son's condition, I had a lot more tests. I had MRIs on the baby, on the fetus. I had, in the UK, we usually have 2 ultrasounds, one at 12 weeks and one at 20 weeks. I had 20.
Oh my gosh.
And every time I was going up to London, and because it was COVID, I had to do that on my own. My husband couldn't come with me. So I was going up to London, and you have, when you are talking about the potential of a child having a disability, they have to have the conversation with you. What would you do if he had the same condition? So would you terminate for medical reasons? So I was having to have those conversations on my own without my husband. So emotionally it was a lot harder, but physically it was fine.
Oh my goodness. Like I had just said, I don't want to like dive into COVID.
Yeah,
and I know, do you give them the benefit of the doubt that people just didn't know. So they were, but it's like, what was sacrificed for that?
Yeah, it's so hard. Like at the time, obviously I have a medically complex child. So I was like, lockdown. Yeah, I'm shielding. We're not seeing anyone. We took all the precautions. And then when you hear that in the UK, the Conservative Party who were leading were having horrid affairs, were having parties, were doing whatever they want, it just...
And you're like, I couldn't have my husband attend these scans. You know? And yeah, even... It was so funny because I sometimes had wished that I had been pregnant during those initial lockdowns because I'm like an exotic dancer. And I'm like, since the clubs were shut down, that would have been like the perfect time. But no, since doing this podcast and talking to several people who did have COVID pregnancies, so to speak, so stressful in this already vulnerable time of your life, the unknowns. And
so
then
isolating.
Yeah. So, wow.
Yeah.
That's craziness. But you made it through.
Yes.
And then postpartum with the second little guy was
completely different. Completely different. So I had an elective C-section. It was dreamy, honestly. You know, I got up in the morning, I had a shower, I washed my hair, I put some mascara on, I went and had a baby, and I was home within 24 hours. I came back to teaching 10 weeks postpartum.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so really quick, but that was teaching flexibility. We were in, I don't know what number lockdown at that point. So the teaching was online. So that shift away from the studios to online teaching meant that I didn't have to leave the baby. You know, I could literally breastfeed, chuck the baby at my husband, teach for an hour and come back. And I think because of lockdown, I just made a training space at home. I was like, I need this for my mental health and for my physical health. But I was very driven to get back to being able to lift my eldest son. That was my main goal in my pregnancy, was to keep my upper body as fit as I could, as strong as I could. And it's the same with this pregnancy, because I knew, you know, post C-section you can't lift anything heavier than the baby for 6 weeks.
Right.
So that meant I couldn't care for my eldest for 6 weeks, and it will be the same this time. So I was very driven to get back to it, but I also had a lot more knowledge. So I knew how to do it safely, and I knew how to structure my training.
Right. So talking about that, pre and postnatal corrective exercise certification and the focus on the pelvic floor. Did you have any pelvic floor or deep core concerns with either of your pregnancies, like beyond the C-section healing?
So I was always worried about having diastasis, so ab separation.
Mm-hmm.
And after having my first son, I did go and see a women's health physio. And I remember, and I didn't have my qualification then, and I remember being really surprised that she was like, I'd really like to do an internal exam. I would like to examine your pelvic floor properly. And I was like, oh, I'm just worried about my ab separation. Like, just look at my tummy. And she was like, no, I want to assess your pelvic floor, but if you're not comfortable with an exam, then we don't have to. Anyway, I did do it. And she explained that the pelvic floor is the first thing that needs to heal before you even think about your abs. And my course obviously delved really deeply into that. But what she did say was, I have an overactive pelvic floor. And that is something that isn't uncommon in C-sections and in athletes. So I went into pregnancy just assuming my pelvic floor is going to be weak and I need to tighten it. So I was doing Kegels throughout my first pregnancy. Whereas now, and particularly in this pregnancy, I'm so aware of how I'm clenching.
Right.
And I didn't have any pelvic girdle pain. I did have ab separation, but it wasn't significant. But I can really feel it now that I've got my pelvic floor needs to chill out, really needs to chill out whilst I'm pregnant.
That's so interesting. And yeah, everyone is like maybe on a different spectrum of that in terms of like a weak or overactive pelvic floor. But I do think a lot of people in kind of the audience or community that we might be speaking to might be tending towards a more overactive pelvic floor and not even realize.
Definitely. Like, since I started working with women postnatally and even, you know, prenatally, I send them off to this physiotherapist for a proper exam. But they come to me with symptoms and my head is already thinking, it's overactive. You think it's weak, but I think it's overactive. And sometimes what is hindering their pole progress, you know, this is completely outside of babies, but sometimes the fact that they are clenching so much, they're sucking their stomach in all the time, they're presenting, means that when they do the hard move, they don't have anything more to recruit. Mm-hmm. They're already maxed out. So learning to relax the pelvic floor so that you then can use it better later is, yeah, something I want to try and build into like my pole teaching. And I wish more people were aware of it.
Yeah, I do too. The pelvic floor. It's like, it's something that doesn't come on people's radars until it's not too late, but until there's something already going on.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And even like clenching or tucking the tailbone, people don't realize the different ways they're compensating.
Yeah. And that's what I do at the moment with the pregnancy. Like, I'm just stood there cooking, meal prepping, and I'm suddenly like, I am literally squeezing my butt cheeks and tucking under. Why? Why am I doing that?
That was me when I was pregnant, especially when I did the dishes. I would do the dishes and then my whole body would just feel trashed after. I'm like, what just happened to me?
Yeah, I've been like, I've taught for 3 hours a day before and I felt fine, but doing the dishes or cooking is killing me.
Yeah, it's wild. Like, what the body will try to do. Yeah. I've even seen some sources and research talking about postnatally, when if we're clenching our jaw, it can be connected to pelvic floor dysfunction.
Completely. And going the other way as well, being able to relax and engage the arch of your foot is related to your pelvic floor. It will have a reflective action up the chain.
Oh my gosh, really?
If you lift the arch of your foot, you will automatically lift your pelvic floor.
I have never heard that. I'm so interested in that now. I'm going to play around with that because I'm suffering from ongoing weak pelvic floor postpartum. Yeah. So I'm going to play around with that. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. So like I said, these certifications that you've delved into are only to the enormous benefit of your students. So lucky them. Let's talk just a little bit briefly about your third pregnancy, which you're currently, are you in your third?
Yeah, week 33.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Say hello.
I figured that was going to happen because my mom took my son for a nice long walk.
Nice.
During this recording. And I knew when she came back, the dogs would bark. So sorry about that.
That's okay.
But yes, so your third pregnancy.
Wait, third pregnancy, we decided to start trying in December. And having had the experiences of miscarriage and infertility that I'd had before, I just assumed it's going to take me at least a year until I fall pregnant. Well, that was very, very wrong. I fell pregnant in February.
Oh, wow.
I had just started teaching at a new studio, and I was like, oh God, my first thought was, I'm going to have to tell them that I need time off because I've miscarried. That was just my assumption, that I would miscarry again. And I didn't. I haven't. We're still going through the same tests that I had with my second child. So I had an MRI scan last week. I've had lots of scans. So emotionally, it's easier because I've done it before. And also, I have a very active two-year-old who keeps me incredibly busy. But it has been different from a fitness perspective, because I've got that knowledge and I'm already planning my recovery, and I know that I'll have an elective C-section again. I've already got my date. I'm all booked in. So it feels very civilized to have an elective C-section and be able to plan and have your childcare ready. But I have a low lying placenta. I'm not allowed to do any back bending because of that. And there's also two C-section scars there, so I'm aware of the tissue weakness. I'm more tired than I was before, but that's probably more the toddler than the pregnancy.
Oh my gosh, I can only imagine. Yes, how?
I stopped inverting a lot sooner with this pregnancy, but equally that's partly because I don't really train the big tricks anymore, so I wasn't pushing to keep it. I'm so done. 7 weeks and counting. I'm never doing this again.
I can imagine. It's interesting that I've heard from other people too that having an elective C-section is actually a very calm and peaceful way.
Yeah.
But it's like different frames of mind approaching birth. Like I was very, I don't want to say indoctrinated, because it was my own choice to delve into that world, but in the natural childbirth space.
Yeah.
And it's like C-section is this great fear.
Yeah.
But I think
for a lot of people.
Yeah. I think that if a C-section happens after a long and like very fraught labor and you're still clinging to this ideal, then yes, it could definitely be traumatic. But like you said, knowing the end date, not having to go like say 12 days post your due date and wondering, and then not even knowing
and going
who's
through,
gonna watch my kids, because when is this gonna happen?
Yeah. And going through a long labor where you're not gonna have slept. You're not going to have eaten. You probably won't have drunk enough. Your body isn't set for recovery. Whereas having an elective C-section, like I will have a good protein filled meal the night before. I'd say I'll get a good night's sleep, but I'm pregnant, so I won't. I have to be in at the hospital at 11 a.m. So my mother-in-law will take my two-year-old, will be able to put my son on the bus to school. I've got carers lined up for them in the evening. It's just so different. And I know I'm going to have an incision. I've got the big pants ready. I've got everything I need.
Yeah, I can see that would be nice. And since you have the benefit of experience taking the fear of the unknown out of it a little bit for the C-section.
It's not as medical as people think it will be. Like we had lowered lights, we had music playing that I wanted. It was straight away. So the baby was born. They show you the baby. My husband cut the cord, and then he was straight onto my chest for skin to skin. And I just had, I'm aware that they're working on me down there, but I'm holding my baby. I didn't care what they were doing.
Yeah.
I was having the lovely snuggles. And then you go into recovery and that's it. And you have an incision, but it's manageable. You don't have the bleeding that you have. Well, I didn't have the bleeding that you have with a natural birth, because they kind of tidy you up.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. And I think, you know, if you do have a C-section, the one thing I think people need to remember is ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask your midwife to pass you the baby or to help you.
Be a hero, right?
Yeah. Just ask for help. This is what they're there for. Take the drugs as well. Take the painkillers.
Well, thank you for sharing that kind of different perspective on a C-section birth. If there's anyone listening who hasn't had their first child yet or is currently pregnant, I think it's really good to hear that perspective so that maybe they just open their mind to the different ways babies can be born.
Definitely.
I was wondering, and you don't have to, you can answer this however you want, but having gone through that first unexpected experience and knowing you wanted to grow your family, do you feel like you had lingering fears or anxieties kind of following you through the journey of growing your family? Or were you really able to kind of manage that emotionally?
If that
makes sense.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. We definitely had anxiety. I think in terms of, did we have anxiety that the subsequent children would have a condition? I think both my husband and I were very much of the opinion that everyone has a risk in having a child with a difference. That's why they do the screening for things like trisomy 13 and Down syndrome. So everyone has that risk. There was particularly...
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
Okay, go ahead.
there was for me a lot of trauma from the miscarriage, from the DNC, from the first miscarriage, and from, I'd say, NICU trauma, separation from my baby.
Oh my
which
gosh.
I think I didn't address when I was just with him, because I was so focused on I need to get him therapy and everything in that he's got and that he's achieved, we have fought hard for. So that was my focus. But then, of course, I fell pregnant and it all started to come back. And it was COVID, so I dwelled on it a lot. And I didn't have my normal releases, you know, going to a class, even teaching in person. And it's something I've struggled with this pregnancy. But I perhaps feel a little bit more confident because I've got such a good medical team around me. I know, you know, I've got meetings coming up with the NICU team so that if he does need to go into intensive care, there's a plan in place. And that's with actually a doctor who was the first doctor to see my son when he was 24 hours old. So she's like a friend now.
Oh,
so
wow.
Yeah, it's there's definitely... There's definitely trauma there. There's definitely PTSD, which I've tried to find therapy for, but no one is quite... It's a very specific form of therapy and I've not found the right person to help me. Yeah. And I just bury myself in other things to distract myself.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. That is more so the loss and NICU.
Yeah.
Trauma, I guess, that has kind of followed through, which absolutely makes sense. And again, just thank you so much for sharing some of those somewhat less talked about parts of motherhood. I know it's just important to share and hear other people's stories. So thank you very much. We're coming up towards an hour. Mm-hmm. What advice would you like to pass on to pole dancers who are about to enter their motherhood journey in terms of fear of the unknown, either related to motherhood or just even to being able to come back to pole?
Yeah, I think fear of the unknown is something that you can't really overcome because it is unknown. That you can listen to people's stories, but your own journey is going to be different. And I would just say when it comes to birth stories, I remember having so many people tell me their horror stories. It's okay to say, I don't want to listen to this and not listen to it. But in terms of and I think that's really important, try not to listen to the horror stories because I think it just makes everything worse. But when it comes to coming back to pole will always be there. And it's absolutely okay for you to want to come back to it. I really hate the narrative of, or when you have the baby, you won't want to do that anymore, or you won't have time to do that anymore. Like, yeah, your life is going to be different, but it's important for you to have time. And if that's your passion, then you need to do it. You need to put yourself first sometimes. Yeah, it's something I've been finding with this pregnancy. Like, I had someone say to me last week, I have ridiculously long hair. And someone said to me, oh, third child, you'll have to cut your hair short.
Why?
Why? Yeah, literally, why? Oh, so it'll be more manageable. You won't have time to do it.
What a bizarre comment.
Yeah. And first of all, I was like, if you know anything about me, my hair is the easiest thing. I literally wash it, leave it, and it curls. It's easy. But why do I have to change myself? Like, you know, changes will happen, but I don't have to give up things I love. And I don't think pole dancers should feel like they have to give up something they love.
Yeah, you don't have to conform to this textbook image of what being a mom looks like.
Yeah.
And I just also remembering your first postpartum story, mm-hmm. I think you can want to come back to it, but we should also respect how we feel in the moment too, because there may be times where you almost feel like you should want it, but your reality mm-hmm. is in that moment that you actually want to step back, and that's okay too.
Yeah. And I think whatever you're feeling is fine, and no one will judge you. I think we think a lot about what people will think of us, and actually other pole dancers will not judge you if you're like, I want to spend time with my baby.
No. And like you said, pole will always be there, but especially in the social media landscape, we can feel like everything is happening without us and that things are rushing by.
Yeah. And actually, probably aren't. They probably aren't. And there's always going to be a space for you in the pole world. And it may look different to how it was before, but that's fine. And that could be exciting as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I imagine with you shifting more to focusing on dancing, you've been able to evolve your personal style even more through that shift.
Definitely.
Yeah. So silver lining. Thank you. That is amazing advice. I love to hear it. So before we let you go, where can people find you online or find your digital offerings for teaching?
Yeah. So I have a website, which is emilylaura.com. And I'm just about to start launching lots of tutorials that I've been working really hard on. You see me going from like a little bump to a really, really big bump in some of these tutorials. So I will be bringing out flexibility tutorials, heels flow, and my one true love, edge work. There'll be different offerings, different levels. There'll be beginner stuff. There'll be advanced stuff. There'll be 1 hour classes. There'll be half an hour classes. And I'm going to start launching those. So it's the end of September now. So pretty much next week.
Okay. That's good timing to kind of come into where you maybe will want to take a step back from filming or teaching in real time.
Yeah. I just finished up filming this week and I'm like, I'm done now. I need a break.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I will link your website and your Instagram in the show notes below so the listeners can find you. And thank you again for making the time, busy mom of two, soon to be three, and for sharing. And to the listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you love this conversation as much as I did, and we will talk to you all next time. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Dancer Mama podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please consider subscribing so you don't miss an episode. I'd love to know what you thought, so please leave a rating, review, or connect with me on Instagram at the Dancer Mama podcast. See you next time.